a robust understanding of who God is essential for us to fully, to better appreciate His work in our life. Tonight we're going to look at 2 Samuel chapter 22, and we're going to give thought to how God worked in the life of David. And sometimes we have a very overinflated view of ourselves, our self-worth, and who we are. Now, don't misunderstand me. We are created in the image of God. God, we have intrinsic value made as the crowning jewel of His creation. Yet, biblically, we learn that we are but dust of the earth. The old song says that He would show grace to such a worm as I. So a robust theology, a proper understanding of who God is, helps us better understand the magnificent grace that He bestows upon us, that He would work in our lives in the way that He does. We do not give much thought to some little random ant crawling across the concrete or pavement in front of us, showing mercy or kindness or grace. Yet God, who is so much higher than we are, much more than we are of an ant, condescended, became like unto us, and does wonderful and incredible things in our life, taking notice of little tiny creatures that we are. And we see this on full display in this song of praise given to David by inspiration. He lived those moments. He endured those difficulties. Yet God inspired him to use the pain, the deliverance, the mighty things that God had done in his life to offer up this psalm of deliverance, psalm of praise. And what I'm interested in planting in your mind this evening is that what David writes about, what David sings about, we too can sing about. We don't share in the same physical battles like David did. Anyone here physically done combat with a bear, a lion, or a 9-foot giant? No. But we have enemies. And by that, I don't necessarily mean flesh and blood, but spiritual enemies, those who seek to do us harm, our old, sinful, Adamic nature, sin itself as an enemy to our soul, Satan as an enemy of our soul. And while we can't say we've been physically where, like David, his spoiled son orchestrated a coup d'etat and drove him from the throne, still we battle with enemies from within and enemies from without. And the same God that delivered David is the same God that delivers us. The God, Yahweh, that David writes about is our God. And He is the God we know. And I want to talk a little bit more about that together with you this evening. I will read as we make our way through. I just put verse 1 through 51 because that's how long the song is. But we're not going to look at all of it. As I have battled in my mind, wrestled in my mind, how to handle this, I'm sort of trying to take a middle of the ground, middle ground approach, middle of the road approach. So we could look at it from a telescopic view. That is, stand way, way back and look at these 50 verses and one sermon and be done. Or we could look at it a microscopic view and look at each individual verse and even some of the words in each verse, and it would take us weeks, months to get done. My goal is to take something of what I'm calling a panoramic view, and that is just a more general, broad view. And to do that, I have broken up this song into my... This is not David's. It's not inspired. I've broken it down the way it makes sense to me. And I hope that maybe it will make sense to you as well. Let me just remind you, verse 1, David spake unto the Lord the words of this song in the day that the Lord, that Yahweh, had delivered him out of the hand of all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul. So this is probably written later in David's life during an era of peace in which he'd been delivered from Absalom and Sheba and from Saul and all of his enemies that sought to dethrone him. Probably later in his life, he writes this psalm, and it is a song of praise. This is what this is. It's a song of praise. And it is filled with imagery, poetry, and theology. You will find these three things throughout this song: imagery, poetry, and theology. Now, outside of Miss Pat, I probably spend more time with Brenda here at church than anybody else. And so she gets to see more of the not in the pulpit side of the preacher. And so sometimes that includes me saying, Brenda, don't put another poem in the bulletin this week. Brenda likes poetry. I don't really like poetry. Roses are red, violets are blue. I don't like poems, and neither should you. Would you know, or do you know, that preachers, most books on preaching encourage Bible teachers, preachers, to read lots of poetry? Because it helps your vocabulary, it helps with rhyme, it helps with prose, it helps with imagery. And Brenda loves poetry, and I'm not knocking on her, thank God for it, the Bible's full of it. And what we find in this song is imagery. There's some imagery, we're going to talk about some of it in just a minute, and there's a lot of poetry there. Some of this gets lost in translation. There are, in the Hebrew, there are some sets of prose. Like, we would look at it as lyrics, rhyming lyrics. But in Hebrew, it's more about phonics than it is about the rhyme. But nonetheless, that gets lost in translation. And I try not to tell everything that I learned. But imagery, poetry, and theology. There's some rock-solid theology in this. But then also, as I mentioned to you, I think that we can find the Messiah in this song. It is messianic. It is a messianic song that points us to the Lord Jesus Christ. Here in verse after verse, David declares both who God is and what God has done with him. Let me remind you, as I said last week, that David makes known that it is Yahweh God that has done this. If I wear you out with this, I'm sorry. I just think it's important. When we see Lord, the Lord, Lord, all capital letters, it is the specific name of God, Yahweh. King James often translates it as Jehovah. Either way you like, it's fine with me. It is Yahweh. And David is saying it is not Baal. It is not Ashtaroth. It is not Ra. It is not any of those other Canaanite gods or Philistine gods, but it is the one true living God that has delivered him. This is, as we said, an ancient, long extended form of how great thou art. This is David's own version, rendition of how great thou art. And I've broken it up by generally, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I've broken it out into 12 sections. We're only going to get through just a few of those together this evening. I want you to notice with me first, and since we've already really tackled this, I'm only going to say a few things. But I want you to notice first the God who saves. The God who saves in verses 2 through 4. And he, that is David, said, Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. Again, I ask you to take notice of the word my, how very personal that this was for him. The God of my rock, in him will I trust. He is my shield and the horn of my salvation, my high tower and my refuge, my Savior. Thou savest me from violence. So notice the God who saved. The God who saves. And he does so, David would say, by being his rock, fortress, deliverer, shield, horn of salvation, high tower, refuge, and Savior. He is the God who saves. Now, as we mentioned last week, there is a very clear application from the life of David. He hid in rocks and caves. He was dependent upon shield as he fought in battle, having a shield. He understood about the horn of salvation and what that symbolized, the strength that that symbolizes. God is his rock, his refuge, his deliverer. As somebody who lived on the run, whose life was constantly under threat for many years, both before he ascended the throne and after he ascended the throne. So he understood that he had a number of violent enemies, yet he would say that God saved him from them all. And again, we're not necessarily like David running from Saul, fighting giants. We don't have a family who's trying to usurp the throne, but we do have enemies. And we can say, David's God is our God. And what God did for him, both physically and spiritually, he has done for us spiritually. And in a sense, we have been delivered physically as well from the enemy of death, the grave. And I have said, and I said this last week, only eternity will unveil all that God has sheltered us from and shielded us from. We really have no earthly idea all that God has done in our behalf. But we can say David's God is our God. And he is singing a song, writing a song, lifting his voice about the God he knew. But this is also the God we know. It is our God who saves us. Yahweh who saves us. And then in verses 5 through 7, I want you to notice the God who hears. We notice the God who saves in verses 5 through 7 now, the God who hears. Notice verse 5 in this picturesque language, imagery, when the waves of death compassed me. You ever been to the beach? Get out there in the water, and some waves come in, and next thing you know, one smacks you down, and you try to get back up on your feet, and it smacks you back down again. Has that ever happened to you? And you realize how puny you are, how small you are, and if you're not careful, you'll get tossed and tumbled and pulled out by the tide. This is the imagery that David is using, that there is a seemingly ceaseless waves of enemies attacking. You know how it is, brother. You know how it is, sister. Sometimes in life it just seems like it's just one thing right after another. There are waves. It's not just a wave, but there are constant waves coming. He says it is the waves of death that had surrounded him, compassed him, the floods. You see that imagery, the vivid language, the floods of ungodly men made me afraid. The destructive power of a flood. The sorrows of Sheol, the sorrows of hell compassed me about. The snares of death prevented me. In verse 6, where it talks about the sorrows of hell, that is the word Sheol, which is just a symbolic of death. The sorrows of death compassed me about. The snares of death. And again, here's some King James language at the close of verse 6. The snares of death prevented me. And I think maybe I could help you by going over to 1 Thessalonians that those who are alive and remain will not prevent us or precede us. And that's what that word means in Old English, to precede or go before. So David is saying traps, snares of death went before him. Again, he was a man on the run. Saul tried to take his life endlessly. Do you remember what he told Jonathan? He said, Jonathan, there is but a step between me and death. One wrong move and I'm done for. And David says, this is God. I'm sorry, this is life. But, verse 7, in my distress, I called upon the Lord, called upon Yahweh, and cried to my God, and he did hear my voice out of his temple, and my cry did enter into his ears. This is the God who hears, David says. I had all of these seemingly unending trials and troubles, waves, floods, sorrows, snares. And in my distress, I called unto my God Yahweh, and he heard me from his temple. Dear Christian friend, in the midst of your sorrows, in the face of death, when there is flood upon flood, wave after wave of trials and troubles that seemingly, endlessly come to you, in your distress, call out to your God. He is the God who hears us. He not only heard David from his temple, and again, David is making that high, lofty language of God sitting in his heavenly temple on the throne, and yet as small and almost insignificant as he is, the Creator of all heard his cry. Again, my little simple analogy of a little ant crawling on the road, on the pavement in front of us, how much compassion. Were they to call out in mercy, and yet God hears us. As tiny and insignificant as we are, our prayers, our cries ascend up into his temple. And notice the close of verse 7, they did enter into his ears. It's not a matter of if trouble comes, but when it comes, to whom will you turn? To whom or to what will you turn? Trials, sorrows, waves of affliction, floods of uneasiness and anxiety and struggles, and all of these are going to come upon us. To whom will you turn? To whom will you go? To whom will you seek refuge? And the only place that you can go and find true help is in God Yahweh, the one true living God. In your distress, call upon the God who hears us. And then in verses 8 through 16, I want to read that, but I want you to see the God who astounds. We've seen the God who saves, the God who hears, but now the God who astounds. And I want to read verses 8 through 16, and I want you to see the very bold imagery David employs to portray God not as some weak, frail, gray-haired old grandpa with two or three marbles rolling around in his mind. That's not who God is. David knew from where his help came. His help came from the Lord, from Yahweh. And he is mighty to save, powerful. And he's going to use some very demonstrative and descriptive language in showing us this astounding God. Look at verses 8 through 16. When David cried, and understand, in response to David's cry of distress, this is what God did. This is how God replied. Then the earth shook and trembled. The foundations of heaven moved and shook because he was wroth, angry. There went up smoke out of his nostrils and fire out of his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down, and darkness was under his feet. And he rode upon a cherub and did fly. And he was seen upon the wings of the wind. And he made darkness pavilions round about him, dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. Through the brightness before him were coals of fire kindled. Yahweh, the Lord, thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice. And he sent out arrows and scattered them, that is his enemies, lightning, and discomfited them. And the channels of the sea appeared, and the foundations of the world were discovered at the rebuking of Yahweh, the rebuking of the Lord, and the blast of the breath of his nostrils. Now that's some very descriptive language, isn't it? To use prose and imagery and even some poetry to describe the God who astounds. Think about the mighty, awesome power of our God. His majestic glory, that the heavens cannot contain him. The earth shakes and trembles. And I really think, as I've studied this, and I would agree with the commentators on this, that David's mind is even back to Mount Sinai. You remember when God appeared to Israel at Mount Sinai and thundering and lightning and smoke and fire as like an erupting volcano there because of the presence of God, dark clouds and lightning and God's voice thundering so much that the Israelites were shaking in their sandals. And I think David has that in mind, that the same God that appeared to Israel of old at Mount Sinai is the same God who has delivered him, who has astounded him, who has showed up for him. In his distress, he cried. And the God who came to deliver him was the God that moved the earth. The language that he uses is just to be understood as figurative or symbolic. God doesn't have nostrils. You understand? But he portrays God as this majestic, mighty warrior riding to his defense. In fact, it's almost the idea of God, as it were, climbing upon the back of a cherubim, an angelic celestial being, riding it as he would a horse or a weapon of war, and being brought by a chariot that is fueled by the wind, riding to David's rescue. This is not some impotent, weak God that David has. This is not some frail, unimpressive God that we have. He is the sovereign, majestic, mighty, earth-shaking God, who in your distress you can call upon and he will come to you. You may not see it quite like this, but God can and does very often show up in mighty ways in the life of his people. there is some, I think, prophetic poetry here. Prophetic poetry here that should point our mind forward as well. I said this is a messianic psalm. While I don't want to stretch this too far, I don't want to take it out of context, when you read some of this, it should point your mind forward to the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. When He'll come back in majestic might and power, show up to deliver God's people yet again. He is the God who astounds. Yahweh thundered from heaven. He sent out arrows. He scattered him. Think about that. Think about how Christ will return in glorious power, riding on the back of a horse and coming and speaking and just shaking the earth. This is the God who astounds. And then in verses 17 through 20, notice the God who delivers. David's God was a God who saves, and He is a God who saves us. He was a God who hears, who heard David, and He hears us. He is a God who astounded David. He is the God who should astound us. He was the God who delivered David, and He is the God who delivers us. Verses 17 through 20, He sent from above. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. Again, that picture language, imagery language of David being just overwhelmed and surrounded by floods of adversity. Verse 18, He delivered me. Notice that. From my strong enemy and from them that hated me, for they were too strong for me. You know, again, can I remind you, David is not singing how great I am. He's singing how great thou art. I couldn't handle it. David said, my enemies were too strong for me. Yet he also knew it was God that guided that stone out of his sling right into the forehead of Goliath and crushed him. David's confidence wasn't in himself. He said, the battle is the Lord's. Continue reading with me in verse 19. Again, they prevented me. That is, they went before me. They preceded me in the day of my calamity. But the Lord was my stay. He brought me forth also into a large place. He delivered me because He delighted in me. In verse 18 and verse 20, he says God delivered him. He is the God who delivers. Now, from a very practical sense, isn't that true for the life of David? Delivered from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear, from the hatred of Goliath. He was delivered from the injustice of the cruel hatred and injustice of Saul. He was delivered from Absalom's rebellion, from the counsel of Ahithophel, from Sheba who sought to overthrow him, on and on and on. And that's just the ones we know about. That doesn't count the Philistines and the Edomites and the Ammonites. He had all kinds of battles as well. Yet he would say God delivered him from it all. And not only that, I like this, though it seems like a very small thing. The language is important. Verse 20, He brought me forth into a large place. Now, that don't mean a whole lot to us, but that's the same language that was used of the promised land. He brought me out. Really, David's the language is I was in a strait. I was in a fix. I was caught. I was, as we would say, between a rock and a hard place, but He brought me out into the promised land, into a large place where there is prosperity and there is peace and there is joy. Can you say that this evening? That God has delivered you from your strong enemy, from sin, from self, from Satan, that God has delivered you from them, that they were too strong for you, you couldn't overcome it on your own. In verse 20, that He brought you out and put you in a large place. He delivered you. And why? Because He delighted in you. That's what verse 20, why did He do that? Because it pleased him to do so. That's why. Because he delighted in us. We love him because he first loved us. And then I want to give you verses 21 through 25, and then we're going to close. I've titled this, The God Who Knows. The God Who Knows. And as I read verses 21 through 25, I need you to put your thinking caps on with me tonight, because I'm going to leave you with something that I want you to think about, and I would like you to consider it. And if you'd be so inclined, I'd like to hear some feedback, what you think. Listen to what David writes in verses 21 through 25. Let me read it and we'll walk through it. Yahweh, the Lord, rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands hath he recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord, and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his judgments were before me, and as for his statutes, I did not depart from them. I was also upright before him, and have kept myself from mine iniquity. Therefore, the Lord hath recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in his eyesight. I title this The God Who Knows, because God knows our hearts, our minds, our frames, our obedience and our disobedience. But here's where I need you to think with me this evening. When we read these words of David, you ought to probably just scratch your head just a little bit and say, now wait a minute, we've been following this dude for a minute. This is the same guy that had a lot of wives. This is the same man who looked over at an attractive lady bathing and said, I must have her. And he did. Who then conspired to cover up the fact that he had impregnated her. And when that didn't work, he conspired to have her husband killed. Of course, Bathsheba and Uriah is whom I make reference to. That's not David's only failures, but that's really right up there at the top or bottom of the list, however you want to say it. So how then could David say, notice with this, verse 22, I've kept the ways of the Lord. I have not wickedly departed from my God. All his judgments were before me. His statutes, I did not depart from them. Verse 24, I was also upright before him and have kept myself from mine iniquity. How could David write this when we know what we know about him? That's what I want you to think about. Because David knew more about his failings and sin than we do. We've looked at his life. We've seen both his high points and his low points, his failings, but we haven't seen all of them. But David was not sinless. He was not perfect. And so we're faced with several options as we read this and try to reconcile it, as to get our mind around what does he mean? When he says in verse 21, that Yahweh rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands. And we're like, yeah, but you've got Uriah's blood on those hands, David. And so the options that we have in front of us is this. First, David could mean that in the sight of God, he is positionally righteous, even if he is not practically righteous. Here's what I want you to learn. Christian, in the sight of God, if you are born again, trusting by the finished work of Jesus, you've been justified by faith, in the sight of God, you stand sinless, as if you have not sinned. Positionally, you are righteous before God because he sees you through the finished work of his Son. But now practically, you're still a mess. and so am I. But we will, and you understand, our ultimate sanctification and glorification is just as secure now as it will be 1,000 years from now. So positionally, we are right with God, even if practically we're still struggling with sin. So maybe that's what David means. Maybe he understands that my righteousness is not my own. My faith is in the coming Messiah whose substitutionary work will atone for my sins, and I will stand before God one day judiciously innocent of all offenses because of my faith in His Son, His Messiah. Maybe that's what David means. Even though while he's still on earth was a sinner. Maybe he means, secondly, that the overall tenure of his life, that is the totality of his life, while not sinless, not absolutely perfect before God, the overall aim of his life has been to honor God in all that he does. Maybe that's what he means. One writer said it like this: David was not making mention of sinless perfection, but of his life's direction. In other words, David was saying, I'm not claiming to be innocent, because we've got Psalms 51. I'm not claiming to be perfectly sinless, innocent in that regard, because we have Psalms 51, which is David's psalm of repentance. Before thee and thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight. So David knew that he was a sinner. So maybe he means that while he's not sinless, while he's not perfect, the goal of his life has been to honor God in all that he does. And really, that should be true of all of us. We're not sinless. We're not perfect. But our life's direction should be to honor and hallow the name of God. While we're still in these bodies, we're going to fail. We're going to falter. We may not be complicit, guilty of the same sins as David, but we've got our own. So maybe David is saying here, God knows I'm not perfect. I know I'm not perfect. But my life has been intended to honor the name of Yahweh. He knows. He knows. And I'd like to present a third option to you. And that is this: that David is only speaking in a shadow sense. In other words, David is saying, this was true of me, but only partially true of me. But it will be true of the Messiah of God. In other words, it's possible that this is messianic literature. That this is prophetic, messianic verse. That David is saying, I've tried to live this way. My aim, my intent was to live this way, but I haven't done it perfectly. But the son of David, the descendant that will sit on my throne, he will do this perfectly. And if you were to go back and read these verses with the eye, one eye, and I did this, with one eye on Jesus, it almost fits just perfectly. It really does. So maybe David is saying what is partially true for me will be perfectly true for the Messiah. And so he's pointing our heart and our minds to the coming Messiah King. So, I want to stop there. Much more could be said. Believe me, I'm trying to move somewhat quickly in this panoramic view. But this is the God we know. This is the God David knew. The God who saves, the God who hears, the God who astounds, the God who delivers, the God who knows. But this is also the God who saves us. This is the God who hears us. This is the God who astounds us. This is the God who delivers us. This is the God who knows us and all of our imperfections. And yet still loves us. And like David, that ought to give us a reason to sing a song of praise, a song of deliverance. This is the God we know. It's the God that David knew, but this is the God we know. And it is God who knows us. And God bless you. I love you. Thank you for your patience. This is not, I was telling Steve before church, this is not the easiest chapter of 2 Samuel to deal with. And I may not be doing it well, but I'm doing it as best I can, trying to break this down in a way that is palatable to all of us. God bless you. I love you. Hope you have a good week.